done what we were asked to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's PDC is really turning around.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's exciting.
They've been very good in the last. I really appreciated what they've done in the last year.
Yeah.
Where is this at? Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Portland City Council. Today is Thursday, May 6th, 2010. It's 2 p.m. We're in afternoon session. Hi, Sue. How are you?
Just fine, thank you.
Did you have a good lunch?
I did.
Good. Can you please call the roll?
Fish.
Here.
Saltzman. Leonard. Fritz.
Here.
Adams.
Here. Quorum is present of the City Council, and we have two items on our agenda today. We have three items on our agenda today. We have to keep each first item to an hour, the second item to about 45 minutes, and then we have 15 minutes for the final item. We are all glad that you're here. How many of you have been to the City Council before? All right. So a few things to try to make you feel comfortable in the protocols of this room. We try to maintain a level playing field, a level field of citizen input. So if you like something, feel free to do your hands. If you don't like something, feel free to do this. But we want people, whether we agree with them or not, who are testifying to feel comfortable speaking their minds. So we do not allow clapping, booing, hissing, cheering, any of those kinds of things. But it also provides good exercise for you, so think of it as calisthenics. When you come to testify, unless you're invited, and invited, we're trying to keep everyone within the three-ish minute range, please state your name, full name. We do not want your address, and there's a clock on the table there that will help you count down from three. Finally, if you are representing an organization as a lobbyist, or you are authorized to represent an organization, just provide that as part of saying your name at the front of your testimony. We're really glad you're here, and we're enthusiastic to hear from you. Can you please read the title for item number 641?
Communities of Color Coalition.
Hi, welcome. I understand you'll be kicking us off? Someone.
Yes.
Okay. All right, glad you're here.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Jimmy Dogo. I represent the African community, and I want to welcome you to our community of coalition of co-presentation. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, the Mayor, for taking time to listen to us. And I also want to welcome the audience and thank them for coming. Today, we want to present the finding that after the research that we did regarding disparity within our community of color. The community of color include the Asian, Pacific Islander, the Slavic, the African immigrant and refugees, African American, Hispanic, and Native American. So after the brief presentation regarding the different color, we will have a recommendation to the audience here, especially to the commissioner and the mayor.
Good afternoon, Mayor Adams and members of city councils. my name is Lee Cha. I'm a co-chair of the Coalitions of Community of Color. And to continue our presentation, I'd just like to take a moment to thank the city for supporting this project by also supporting funding to allow the coalition to partner with our Portland State research team to really do this critical work. And I'm hoping that you will find that the information that will be presented to you will be useful, because it is very critical for our community, so that we could actually have some tools and some ways to continue beyond just what we every day try to tell you. But anyway, let me not taking any more time to really share with you a little bit about the community of color. The coalition's mission is to address the socioeconomic disparity, institutional racisms, and inequity of services experienced by our families, children, and community. To organize our community for collective actions resulting in social change to obtain self-determination, wellness, justice, and prosperity. Now, a little bit about the coalition. We actually formed the coalition back in 2001, and the coalition among the various minority community, we do come from a long way, and we also learn very tough lessons on our own. And so especially when we try to communicate to policymakers or when we try to represent our community to provide a voice and talk about the needs of our communities, we often get our community pit against one another, whether or not it is social issues, political issues, or economics or academic issues. Usually when we go on our own, we get a lot of lip services and political answer, and so therefore we learn it the very hard way. And so we very quickly come together and we said, look, we ought to come together and do this together because we have a common needs and we have common issues among us. And so we have really begun forming this around the county, Portland school age, Portland youth and family service system when they tried to change it to the school age policy framework, and today it is the SUN service system. So around that, you know, our community, like El Programa, the Urban League, the Native American Youth and Family Center, the Asian Family Center in ERCO, Latino Network, Self-Enhancement, Africa House, Slavic Coalitions of Oregon, and so on. We have come together for a very common goals and for a very common cause. And so with that, I'll turn it to and to really share with you more in depth about the project findings and the work that we are doing. And again, thank you.
Thank you, Lee.
Thank you.
My name is Ann Curry Stevens. I'm on faculty with the School of Social Work, where we have been partnering with the coalition to prepare this research work. I'm not sure if you know, but today is actually marks the release day of the full report, which is 150 pages in length. Of which we're presenting to you a set of highlights of the findings along with the full recommendations that are being made by the coalition. So to begin this, I'll just flag that we have a few other funding sources in addition to the Northwest Health Coalition or Health Foundation, which has financed us for 3 years, plus the city with Mayor Adams' contribution, encouragement of funding from the city. We've had county money. The coalition themselves, the member organizations, have contributed a significant amount of time and energy to help strengthen and build this report, and Portland State, through release time in addition to a bit of funding, has also contributed to the work. I'm going to go to the synthesis of the findings now and just want to set the scene for this. It's a distressing set of data that we're reporting to you on today. It's hard to face. We ask that deep attention be paid to the fullness of it, encouragement to let yourself be moved by it, and to be willing to be led in terms of directions for change by the coalition, who on behalf of about a quarter of our population is advancing a racial equity agenda that we ask be moved on at all levels of government. So the core findings that we have today is that the numbers of people who are members of communities of color are sizable and growing in numbers. There is an issue around the visibility, which often ties back to traditional counting measures, which are significantly problematic, which I'll review in some depth. The findings revealed very deep and wide disparities of communities of color in their comparison with experiences with white communities. The next piece to flag is that we looked at some comparison issues, some comparison dimensions to this data, and found that we're performing worse here than in King County, home to Seattle. It is worse here than national averages on most measures that we looked at. And there are a couple of ways we've looked at data over time, and the disparities are almost universally worsening. With that bad news story comes a sense of hope in terms of the prospects for change, that different policy environments, different policy platforms hold more promise in terms of better outcomes for communities of color. So in the space for distress, we also find hope. I'm going to spend the next couple slides looking at the numbers of the size of communities of color in the county. And we find today that the numbers between whites and communities of color is narrowing. Communities of color today in Multnomah County make up 26.3% of the population. In the city, communities of color make up 26.2% of the population. Now, these are traditional conventional measures, and they, as I'll explain in a moment, are subject to problems with undercounting. The next piece to flag is that our communities of color are younger and growing quickly. And while on average we make up about a quarter of the population, we actually make up close to 50% of the school population. And what we see here now is a significant pattern of narrowing of people of color taking up a larger, increase and rapidly larger portion of the population of school-aged youth, where white communities made up 70% of the population just 10 years ago. Today, they make up 55% of the population. Communities of color make up 45% of the population. The data for Portland Public Schools in the city is 44%, so very equivalent levels of students of color in our schools. We now encounter the question, I want to try to tackle head on the issue of how communities of color are counted. And there are very different ways to do it. The conventional measures are through the American Community Survey, which is put out by the Census Bureau, which has typically three different measures of communities of color. There are alone figures, meaning you hold a single racial identity, or you hold an alone or in combination with another race and ethnicity. Or you may hold an alone or in combination with or without a Hispanic identity. So there are these three different measures which can be quite convoluted. In the alone figures, there is a significant undercounting of communities of color. In order to address this issue, which is a very important one given how numbers are tied to visibility, to status, and to funding, we really are aiming for a much more accurate count. Numbers of our many people on our coalition have been active in the census complete count for 2010 and are working very diligently to try to encourage as full turnout as possible in order to address in the official sources the kinds of undercount that have plagued the community.
Do you have any impression of those early efforts?
I would defer to other folks on that. I mean, I'm not sure about the response rate. I haven't been tracking how the response rate is going. People are working very hard to increase turnout. Some of the issues that are thwarting turnout are everything from how canvassers are trained, and we've been pushing for a more comprehensive training of that in order to encourage a racial identification for people, in addition to trying to encourage the Census Bureau to hire people of color from those local communities in order who speak the languages. There have been some glitches and some tough times in that process. And we're hoping if in the last report, two figures ago, you can actually see there's a significant, this pointer won't work, a very significant narrowing, and that's the bump up as a result of a census year. So we're hoping that we get another bump up again now.
And we'll be getting a report this afternoon from the Complete Count Committee.
Great.
Separate and apart, where Commissioner Gaffori and I will be giving an update to the council on how we're doing and what we think is the return on the investment we made through the small grants to culturally competent groups who are doing helping us with outreach. So.
Terrific. That two of our communities will not be counted at all. The decision to drop the long form by the Census Bureau means that the possibility for the Slavic community and for the African immigrant and refugee community disappears altogether with the decision just to go to the short form. So that's posing some amount of consternation, and ideally we'll see a much more robust in 2020, a more robust possibilities for canvassing all of our communities. So this is what our, we're turning to the next slide now that shows the profile of communities of color. And in these numbers, you can see a very sizable set of numbers for our communities. And in these are the conventional numbers. In the lighter bars above the Native American and the Latino counts, we have started, to explain those, we have started to begin to develop alternative counts for our communities where we know that there's such a pronounced undercounting dynamic that we're wanting to look at culturally verified alternatives. And so what you see in those bars are the results of, these are draft results, the results of two of those efforts so far. They're underway, and we look forward to more full reporting on that in the near future. The numbers that you see in front of you are the best official numbers that exist today. These are what we call the alone or in combination with or without Hispanic numbers. That does result in what we call an overcount of about 7.7%, but given how profound we think the level of undercount is, including the Native American community, which is approximately a 50% undercount, we are able to say that the 7.7% of overcount is still the numbers we want to see used for official purposes so far. A little bit about the background of undercounting, turning to the next slide. There continues to be a whiteness bias in most conventional surveys, from everything to how race and ethnicity get decided, from who reports, who fills out the forms, are they self-reports, can you identify more than one race or ethnicity? These issues are quite complex, and generally the bias has been towards minimizing and undercounting our communities of color. So this dynamic continues today. The second place is that many of our communities are quite honestly unwilling to complete the forms. Everything from histories of genocide and persecution and fear to current day distrust of governments in terms of how the data will be used, despite commitments from the states that these data won't be used in any harmful way, to a desiring of whiteness, where numbers in our communities of color would prefer to identify themselves as white as opposed to being a person of color. And so this dynamic of whiteness continues to pervade and influences how people self-identify. English language and Spanish language capacity continues to plague accurate counts. About 5% of the county's population do not speak either English or Spanish in order to participate in most conventional surveys. We also have poverty-related issues with frequent moving, absence of a phone that reduces reporting rates. And so just sort of we're not sure the scope of the reach of these undercounts, but we know they're historic, pervasive, and they continue today. What are the impacts for all of us through this undercounting process? For communities of color, it's really clear that we end up with invisibility and tokenistic responses to need. We also have a significant financial impact. The Brookings Institute recently updated the Census Bureau's estimates to say that approximately $1,400 per year per person fails to come into our regions for every person that's undercounted. So one of the core pieces is in all of our interest to maximize the financial resources available to us, and an accurate account is an important dimension. There are political consequences in terms of representation. The final piece I want to address in this slide is that there are significant research consequences, and we're really just beginning to understand the full reach of this. Every time a researcher does a study and decides whether their data is representative of the community at large or not, they compare their figures back to Census Bureau data, often older, often alone figures, because they're quite often confused by the alone or in combination with or without Hispanic dynamic. And so every time a piece of research gets done where there is any kind of comparison, both in terms of recruitment and in terms of assessing whether you have representative samples or not, there is a bias that serves to undercount our communities and has a significant impact for all research and almost all social research that exists. Very few researchers are aware of this. We're hoping to bring much more attention to this issue as we go ahead with the project. So we are advocating and are engaged right now in community verified counts. We are working with the research method to be led by communities of color who are guiding us to say, this is how better counts of our communities can be selected. And so you see in this text some of the specifics about how this is being done. So far, we have a variance of anywhere between close to 10% to close to 50%. Information around undercounting is in that range. We are interested in the possibility of doing a post-census 2010 survey around who has not filled out their reports to get a better sense of undercounting numbers. So that may, we're looking at a way to do this later this summer. So the stand of the coalition in terms of what numbers to use, and so this has an impact on how research gets done, how funding gets allocated, how social problems get understood. The coalition is advocating the position that we want to use alone or in combination numbers with or without Hispanic until the time when our community verified counts are available, and at that point in time, we ask for those to be used as the official counts of our communities. What I'm now going to turn to is the details of the disparities that are challenging communities of color. Today marks the day of the first full report on communities of color. And in the coming months, we'll have a set of six community-specific reports will be made available. So there will be one on the Asian Pacific Islander communities, on the Slavic communities, on the African American communities, et cetera. So there will be a specific report made available in the next stretch of time. What have we found? The magnitude is alarming. What I'm now going to do is to highlight some of these findings. So the first slide we have here is on the income levels between white people and communities of color. And we are so the green bar are the values for communities of color, and you'll see this pattern for those in the audience have a hard time reading the font size on the overhead. The green bar is communities of color. Even just a quick scan, you can look at the significant variance between those two groups. The place I draw your attention to is the far right, which is the individual income level. It is half. The individual income of white people in this county are $33,000 a year, whereas it's $16,500 a year for communities of color. Regardless of the construction of one's family, these levels of disparities are upheld. What I'm now going to turn to is those that are living in poverty. And again, a quick scan at the difference between the gray and the green bars shows that poverty levels are at least double and often three times as high for communities of color as for white people in this county. If we tally and calculate the child poverty rate, one in three children of color lives in poverty, while one in seven white children live in poverty.
There's a statistic I heard the other day, which when numbers, to me, sometimes overwhelm the discussion. Mm-hmm. So you look for the concrete.
Sure.
And someone told me that if you filled every seat in the Rose Garden, mm-hmm. which I think is about 19,000 seats, so imagine a sold-out Blazer game. If you fill them all with children, that's the number of children just in Portland Public Schools, one of six school districts in Portland. who live below the poverty line.
Wow.
19,000 children, the entire Rose Garden, for just one of six school districts.
Wow.
47% of all Native American children in Portland live in poverty.
When we turn to another system, we've taken a look at education. Educational attainment, and I'm going to draw your attention both to the left side of this chart and to the right side of this chart. On the left side, we have a massive variance for amongst those who don't, the likelihood of different groups in our society that are not likely to finish high school. If you are white, you have a 1 in 14 chance of not graduating high school. If you're a person of color, you have an almost 1 in 3 chance of not graduating high school. On the far right-hand side, in terms of the chance of having a degree, it is double. 40% of white people have a bachelor or advanced degree, 20% of people of color. A double level of access to post-secondary education. Now I'm going to turn to some of our school, some of our achievement gap data. And so we've collated the data across the county, so we're covering all the school boards in this dimension. And what we see, and all of the communities of color, and we see a massive gap between, particularly in the area of reading and literature, and a worsening as students get older between white and students of color. In the math gap, it starts bad and it stays bad and worsens. The other piece to add is the full report that we have available today shows that some gains made earlier in the decade have been lost, and that the achievement gap is widening across time. I'm going to turn now to a couple of other school measures. One is preschool disparities. We had access to a kindergarten readiness survey, and we actually find that the readiness for learning capacity is already different by the time kids enter kindergarten. In the discipline arena, kids of color are disciplined much more frequently than white kids. And in PPS, of middle school students, a quarter of African-American students have been suspended or expelled, while only 1 in 14 white students have received such punishment. Dropout rates are significantly different, and you'll see a dropout rate graph in the coming slides. And I draw your attention back to that first piece on education in terms of who doesn't graduate high school. That's the 7% and the 30%. Here's a long-term view around dropout rates. The magnitudes of the difference have been pervasive across history, across the last 10 years. They are pronounced. They are roughly double. While they've been worse than double on a few points in time, we still have levels today that are double.
And this is using the most optimistic set of data.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, the labor market is similarly ripe with disparities. I'm going to draw your attention to the far left bar, which is the access to management and professional jobs, where one in every two whites has access to high-status, high-paid work in those areas, whereas only one in every four has people of color have access to those positions. So at the far left are the best of our jobs. The next column over are the service jobs, which are typically understood to be the worst of our jobs, the lowest pay, the worst working conditions, typically. And at that point, we have an inverted pattern where people of color are highly overrepresented in the service industry.
Do you have, in the bigger report, do you have any trend data on that last slide over time?
No. We have it in the last 2 years, so we have the recent data. Additional disparities, unemployment rates, 35% higher. Now let's get to a couple of pieces that hit closer to home in city public service. In terms of the hiring levels, 16.6% of city employees that are at full-time levels are people of color. We would expect, if there were no barriers to hiring, that that level would be 23.3%. The county does somewhat better with 21% employees of color, while 24.3% is the appropriate target. The targets we looked at are those that are over 18 years old, the population comparisons in those areas. In the city contracting process, which is where many communities of color have aimed to get a start and have expected greater equity, less than 0.1% of construction contracts go to minority-owned businesses. Then, even in the protected contracting program, we have a dynamic where that program is still being used, is being used most heavily and most successfully for white men. And then the last point is that in the contracting, the full contracting dollars, the protected sheltered markets actually give those that are registered with the program sort of first dibs on trying to receive the contracts. Ultimately, only 25% of the total contracting dollars end up going through to communities of color.
Can I make two quick comments off this slide? The first is that the mayor and I are working on the new disparity study, as I think people know, which is assembling the data, which will allow us to come back and make recommendations for strengthening the sheltered market program. So that's underway. And there's a lot of outreach going on. I suspect many of you have already been contacted or will be contacted by the team that's doing it. But I have a question under the hiring in public service.
Yes.
The 23.3% that you identify as parity, that's based on the boosted number that your chart indicated what it should be, or that's based on existing data?
That's based on existing data.
Okay. And have you when you did your analysis, did you take into consideration the trends in terms of people hired over the last few years and what categories they fell into?
We did look at that, and I note in the PowerPoint that it's improved over 13.4%, which was back in 1999. Well, so there have been improvements.
And I think, for what it's worth, I think that Yvonne Deckert the other day briefed us and said that something close to 50% of people hired during a particular period of time were people of color. Now, I have to check that data, but that would be new hires but obviously you have to start somewhere your hiring practices have to improve, and then you look at how you've done in the last couple of years. I'd be interested in actually looking at that data.
Yeah, I think at that briefing, Yvonne Deckert, I think the city's figure now is 20% employees of color.
Would that include the part-time workers, would be my guess?
I don't recall.
Okay.
I know that 20%, I was, you know.
Clearly, we have to do better.
But I took
note
of that.
I'm just interested in both the trend line of how we're doing, as well as the base.
Absolutely.
And the other, to be slightly defensive about the sheltered market program, which I helped put together as a staff person, when we started out, it was 2% contracts going to communities of color. Now it's 11. So progress is possible. Mm-hmm. We're not even close to being where we should be.
Yes.
And I think it's also important to note that the program is designed for emerging small businesses, too. So it's partly the white men that were getting the contracts were emerging small businesses.
Yes.
So I thought that there's a lot of interesting data in that particular audit that the city auditor did. And what was really interesting to me was that particular communities of color, particularly Native Americans and African Americans, had not done as well under that program as we made significant progress in other communities. And it's very helpful to be looking at these.
Wonderful.
And figuring out what we did right, what we could do better.
Yes. Thank you. I'm going to move through a few of these a little more quickly. One is health disparities, the work of the Multnomah County Commission, the Multnomah Health Department on health equities has found low birth weights to be a particular problem amongst our communities. The second piece to look at is the child welfare data. And essentially, the chart in the slide shows that the closer one gets to Multnomah County, the higher rates at which children are removed from their homes. So at the USA level, the Oregon level, the Multnomah County, there's a deepening and a worsening of the rates at which children are taken from their homes. And then once taken, We have a particularly difficult situation facing African American and Native American children, where they are held for very long stretches of time. Housing dimensions, significant numbers of people of color are burdened by their housing, which is typically if one spends more than 30% of your income in housing, more people of color face those challenges than white communities. Home ownership, people of color typically can't afford to purchase homes, with a significant variance with whites of 62% compared to 45%. In terms of current housing vulnerability and being engaged in the subprime market, we have, again, a particularly devastating situation in terms of communities of color having much higher rates of high-cost mortgages and much worse treatment in the lending industry, where they're denied loans much more frequently, even where they're at the same income level. Access to housing support programs. The chart on the left gives you a breakdown of those that are poor. 45% of them are people of color. Mm. We have a fairly bright spot there in that there seems to be pretty close to equity in those that receive tenant vouchers. We haven't yet been able to unpack as to whether or not those are ones that actually use those housing vouchers as opposed to being awarded them. We haven't figured that out from the data yet and look forward to some more dialogue about it. But in the public housing arena, communities of color face significant barriers in terms of access to public housing. We would expect the same proportion that are poor to show up in the public housing data, and it's far from that case at this point in time. Homelessness data, significant overrepresentation. If you can imagine the cascading effects of income and occupation and unemployment and housing imperilment, ultimately people are without housing. And so this is the data for the homelessness profile. And we have particularly that our Native American and African American communities are overrepresented in that data. We, in terms of dialogue about this, it's very likely that the Latino and Asian communities are undercounted. The couch surfing and doubling, tripling, quadrupling up and staying with short-term arrangements with friends is more pronounced there. And so we're looking forward to the better count for the homelessness count to, we think we'll get a better picture of what's happening at this point in time. Access to homelessness services is disproportionate at this point in time.
When you say, I'm just curious, when you say a better count on homelessness, we estimate 1,600 to 2,000 sleeping outside last night. Another 5,000 people we consider the hidden homeless sleeping in cars, on couches. We have, thanks to Mark Jolin and Join, we've working with the census to do an aggressive, a much better, frankly, from our point of view, count of people who are homeless. Is there another count you're hoping we do to sharpen the numbers?
We haven't had a chance at the coalition to look at this in more full detail. There are some meetings planned with people in the homelessness initiative to talk about this. The better count was to start capturing people that are precariously housed in terms of the couch surfing, which didn't show up in these numbers in the year prior to this year. A bright spot, voter turnout. a breath of sense of balance, a little bit of a balance. Voting patterns are improving for communities of color. The voter turnout rate surged significantly from 39% to 54% in 2008. There's still a variance with white communities, and it's believed particularly important that candidates of color are more likely to increase the turnout rate for our communities of color. What I'd like to do now is to turn, and I'll move through this very briefly, is to look at some of our comparisons. Our first one I mentioned already, the comparison with King County, with an average worse count in terms of disparities of 33% on these important measures. Second piece is to look at the national averages. And in this arena, we looked at incomes. And what we did is in these different income levels, we took a look at how people compared to the national average and how people compared to their local experience, comparing whites and communities of color. And the green bars essentially show the economic hit to communities of color that comes from living in Multnomah County as compared to sort of a generalized experience of living elsewhere in the USA. Those are distressing. What's particularly distressing is that that's in the face with a bump up for white families, individuals, and those at retirement levels. And so there's a disparate impact economic of living in this region.
Can you go back to that? Just, I want to make sure I'm under. So the green is bad. Is that right?
Well, the green is communities of color. Anything to the left of the vertical bar is a hit.
Right. The bigger the green bar, the worst off.
Yes.
Okay. And then how do I, so this is the cost benefit. So ideally, just so I understand the depiction, there would be a balance between the green and the purple. Is that right? The more balanced the two bars are, the better off.
The absence of disparities between the national and the local. If they were both at the same, it would show an absence of disparities. We wouldn't aim for all the gray or purple bars to be over on the left, but that would show an absence of disparity.
I see.
But certainly the point where there's a hit for communities of color, whereas there's a perk for white communities, is particularly troubling.
So why is the all households in aggregate moved over to the left side for the white communities, whereas individually they're all on the other side?
So our best way of understanding that is the household figure also includes two-income friends living together. So it's not an aggregate of all of the above. It's a completely different measure. So it's every household. And so it's capturing a scenario where individuals are together or there are multiple families together that wouldn't be captured in the above data. Some researchers work with households, others work with families, and it just captures both those dynamics. I'm aware that we're running through time. So I will move.
It's really, really insightful work.
Is this PowerPoint going to be available for people to get online?
Absolutely. I will turn to Mr. Lee, and we'll have the specifics for you in a moment.
I think that the public are going to want to look through the data yes. carefully also. Thank you.
Mr. Lee?
Well, okay.
Or do you want to? Everyone be fast.
Yes. Everyone be fast. Or we may have to skip through the specific data, and then we'll just get on to the recommendation. Okay. So in that case, we were going to skip some of the slide.
Okay.
And in that case, so rather than share with you the ethnic Pacific data, we're just going to go ahead and move on to the recommendation because we...
Can I just take 30 seconds?
Sure.
To say this is the first time that anybody's seeing a profile of the experiences specifically of the African immigrant and refugee community and for the Slavic community. And so this is a source of new information for us to look at. And it's quite alarming in unique ways. And the other piece to say is that while the Asian and Pacific Islander community typically does really well when you look at national data, it does not do well when you look at Multnomah County data. In fact, the Asian community looks much more like other communities of color than it does the white community, which is where our most common understanding of their economic performance is.
Good afternoon, Nicole Maher, Tlingit Tribe, Southeast Alaska, Native American Youth and Family Center. And I'm just going to give a little bit of a summary. And we've worked very hard to come up with consolidated recommendations that all of our communities are united and want to present those to you today. So this project has taken us 2 years to complete. One of the greatest challenges that all of our communities have faced is that we know that we have great disparities, and those disparities are deep. And what we've commonly experienced is, rather than really having a dialogue around the solutions and what we're going to do, the tendency has been to really debate the data, you know, talk about, well, maybe this is, you know, a mistake on this point. And what the full report really does is it takes literally every piece of data available from the city, the county, the state, and looks at it all. And it all tells the same story, that we have significant disparities and that people of color are living a very different experience than white folks in this community. And so it was very important to us that we all come together, compile this report, and end that debate and move forward to a real conversation about what we're going to do differently and how we're going to behave differently. The most important thing for us is really talking about moving forward and really having strong allies and courageous leadership in making true change. And so some of my counterparts are going to talk about some of those specific recommendations. Oh, I apologize. I actually have the first two. The first two recommendations are actually one of the things that we did is we went through, we not only looked at the need, but we also looked at the outcomes and how different things were taking place. So we looked at not just how many people are homeless, but what percentage of the dollars that serve homeless people reach our populations. And there's great differences. And I think they gave me this slide for a reason, but we looked at when you look at the county and when they do specific investment in culturally specific organizations, they have significantly different outcomes. When you compare Portland to Seattle and you see that Seattle has really worked very hard to embed services in the communities that have the greatest need, they have very different outcomes. And so one of our first recommendations is that the city of Portland really needs to look at strategic ways to ensure that the populations with the greatest needs are served by those that have a demonstrated track record and ability to do that. So that's our first recommendation. And frankly, the city's really behind in this area. There's been a lot of apprehension to do that, and the results of many of the city programs speak to that. The other piece is that we really believe in a comprehensive equity initiative that really looks at the city and are looking for leadership and commitment from this council to do that. So I think we have.
Great. And the second recommendation that we would like to ask you to do is that we're urging all of the funding bodies to begin to implement a need-based funding allocations to seek to really look at the challenges that exist among the community of color and looking at your resource and distributing your resource accordingly. Third, emphasizing poverty reduction strategy. Poverty reduction must be an integral element of meeting the needs of community of color. A dialogue is needed immediately to kickstart economic development efforts to hold the needs of community of colors in high policy implementation. And so these are the couple of the second and third recommendation.
I'm just going to be loud, I guess. And the fourth one.
You have to move. I'm sorry. Please introduce yourself. Yeah.
My name is Victoria Leiboff, and today I represent the Slavic Coalition of Oregon, a grassroots organization that represents a diverse population of people from former Soviet Union and some Eastern European. And I urge you to look at the Slavic data later. And before that, I would just say thank you very much. This is the first time for our community to have data and be heard. So thank you for your support. So the fourth recommendation is a reduction of disparities with firm timelines, policy commitments, and resources. The coalition urges the state, county, and city governments to establish firm timelines with measurable outcomes to assess disparities each and every year. Plan for disparities reduction must be developed in every institution, be developed in partnership with the communities of color. And of course, external accountability must feature into these advances.
Hi, I'm Gerald Deloney with Self-Enhancement Incorporated and representing the African-American perspective. I wanted to say hi to the SEI students that just walked out the room.
What's that all about?
Maybe they saw me coming up and said, better go.
You take the mic. Yeah. Happens to me all the time.
So here's Gerald goes again.
Yeah. And where's,
by the way, I was at an Urban League forum recently, there was a question that we were given in advance which didn't come to me, and I was hoping all night it would come to me because I wanted to say that a great man once said that we don't have a problem with children in this community. We have a problem with adults. And you might know who I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He signs my paycheck.
There you go.
Yeah. So, so you're absolutely right. And before I start, I wanted to say that, you know, through the misery index, there is a relationship between all of those different items that we looked at. And you can't get a good education if you don't have access to health care. If the opportunity structures are different so that you can't get employment, you can't do these kind of things. So there is an interrelationship with all of the measures that we saw. And so we can't take a single focused approach and think that we can fix this little area over here. And the other thing I'd like to say is that this is systemic. You know, it's like people of color have been like the canaries in the mine. You know, it's like the financial system or education system. When it caves in enough, then we say, before it caves in, we say, oh, those people have a problem. But once it starts caving in, then we've got a problem. And so we finally entered that point right now that we've got a problem. And so as we go on with the recommendations, we're talking about those counts as we talked before, that we need to get better counts. And I know, especially in the African-American community, we have people that may be of mixed race and just choose, although they're as dark as I am, they choose to be Caucasian, or they choose to be another race rather than, you know, there's racial confusion as well as those kind of things. So we get undercounts all the time. And then the other thing is prioritize education and early education. Education is done on a continuum. And if we ever say that they're okay now, that we're not giving them enough, that support is over now, then we start losing kids.
Good afternoon, Council and Mayor. My name is Carmen Rubio, and I'm with the Latino Network. The seventh recommendation is to implement research practices that make the invisible visible. It's critical that research practices that are transparent, easily accessible, and accurate in the representation of communities of color are implemented across all institutions. The eighth recommendation is to fund community development. It's also critical that institutions invest in community development by building line items into state, county, and city budgets for communities of color to self-organize and develop pathways to leadership and civic engagement leadership within and outside their own communities. And one example that was highlighted earlier is, and a good step in this direction, is the Diversity and Civic Leadership Project, component of ONI. There's still a way to go to achieve parity with this model, yet it's an important acknowledgement of the need for community development resources for all communities of color.
And the last two recommendations are very important and very relevant to the city. Certainly, disclosing race and ethnicity data for all programs and activities is very, very critical. Again, to be very frank, as we went through this process for 2.5 years, we worked with and partnered with the state, the county, you name it. And one of the greatest challenges we faced was really an organizational culture issue amongst each of the bureaus within the city, a real defensiveness to have this conversation, a real resistance to releasing the data. In no other circumstance did we wait for the length of time to get data. In no other circumstance did we repeatedly have to re-clarify to do public information requests rather than partner with the different bureaus to get it. And in many occasions, we actually had to go through a process of actually going back and saying, we did get the actual data, what you're sharing with us doesn't match. And so what we are concerned with, and we want to be really specific in a very hopefully helpful way, is to really talk about the leadership needed by this council to help change that culture of defensiveness. It's very clear that we're not at a place at the city where middle management and leadership can feel comfortable saying, we're not doing that well, we need to do better. It's much more of, well, we tried this, or we're going to, you know, mess with the numbers until it looks okay. And that's a real leadership issue of really saying it's okay to admit that we're having challenges, but let's work towards improving it versus having the debate of it's really not that bad. And that's really what we experienced across the board with the city, to be quite honest. And so really that level of transparency and honesty, we have no desire as the coalition to make someone feel guilty. We're not looking to blame anyone. We're looking for change. And if we don't identify where we have challenges, we're not able to do that change. So there's a real need for allowance, for honesty, so that we can move forward. The last piece, again, very uncomfortable, but we've looked at all of these indicators. Clearly something is amiss in this community. And so what all of these indicators tell us is that people are being treated differently in this community, and it is directly tied to their race and ethnicity. We're uncomfortable admitting that, and so we just avoid the conversation. And that holds everyone back. When 50% of your children are communities of color and they're having this experience, that means our entire city is having this experience. So we need every ally and every resource to resolve this issue, and part of that is naming our problem, which is partially racism. The last piece is really talking about next steps. We'd like to work with you to establish a very concrete timeline in the next 2 months to meet and talk about a real action plan. We want to commend Commissioner Fritz, who's already been initiating some of these meetings to have these conversations. We want to invite the entire council to make this a priority. I think we've been very clear with our recommendations, and I think we wanted to reserve the rest of the time today to hear from the council about their response to some of this data and some initial conversation about what are some very concrete next steps that we can take together.
Questions from the council.
So I have a couple of questions. And one is, what are a couple of examples of ways in which the county, when presented with this data, has changed their existing policy or practices in a way that begins to move in a better direction, that is illustrative of some things that we should be thinking about when we do our follow-up?
Just, sure. I can answer that. For several years back, the county, made a commitment that as part of their SUN services and their programming, they wanted to have a focus on children in poverty. And so we feel like that's an appropriate priority. We support that. In 2001, we noticed that while 67% of the children living in poverty were children of color, in the target areas they were discussing, only about 5% of the resources were reaching children of color. And so we worked very closely with the county to talk about the variety of services that were part of that portfolio. We established very clear recommendations about having targeted outreach contracts, meaning that you would not discriminate against anyone, but you would develop services that directly tied appropriate services to those demonstrating the greatest need. So while they contract services for anti-poverty, and certainly everyone is expected to serve those in need who present themselves, there are targeted contracts, and they ensure that a decent and adequate proportion of those contracts goes to target communities of color who demonstrate the greatest need. So that's one very concrete example. And when you disaggregate the outcomes from the city and the county, you will see that the county has been much more effective at serving communities of color. It's not a perfect system. There's still room for improvement, absolutely, but it has much better impact. Seattle has done similar work, and there's also some very promising practices that have taken place in Minneapolis and Chicago. So I have more examples, but those are a few. Consistently, what we've heard from folks at the city is this real, no, we can't do that. We don't want to discriminate. So it's almost like we'd rather keep doing things the way that we are versus risk discriminating. And so there's a real fear, I suppose. So we've actually encouraged some of the attorneys at the city to talk with some of the attorneys at the county. Again, the county's not a perfect model, but it's something to examine to start the conversation. Does that help?
Yes, and we can continue this conversation, bureau by bureau and in the follow-up. One of the things that occurred to me as the housing commissioner is that without greater transparency, it's hard to track this stuff more generally. And so I'll give you an example of where the conversation that we initiated 2 years ago with communities of color has changed a practice that I think is going to bear fruit, and we'll be able to judge that based on the findings of awarding contracts and dollars into housing. But, for example, at the Portland Housing Bureau, Director Van Vliet has done a new process for awarding money within urban renewal districts, and she's doing it with a NOFA, Notice of Funds Availability, rather than the old technique, which was, frankly, if someone had a good project and they could get in the building, they could make a deal. It didn't mean those were not good deals, but they didn't give us the same transparency in looking at the range of providers and needs and then being able to sort of publicize that. In addition, something that we've learned, and I know we're in the sort of baby steps here, but is that before doing RFPs, there's an opportunity to bring more people to the table and say,